Glenn, Mike, and I were talking in our office, too. I mean, I kind of felt the same way, that that money would go from the gold, silver, or whatever, come over to the grain. So I kind of agree with you on that possibility.
You know, the thing about that I think a lot of people are going to overlook is, I think people are right to be worried about a brief psychological pressure. I think that was part of today's down in the grains today, was the fear over the stock market and the other markets getting hit. I thought that was part of today's weakness in the grains. I don't think it was all of it by any means, but I think it was part of it. But what I think a lot of people miss on that is, even if we get a fear factor and kind of an implosion in those other commodities and we scare a lot of the buyers, it only takes a fraction of that money to move to the grains and oilseeds because of the differences in the size of the markets. You know, you take 11 billion bushels of corn at $2 cash, that's $22 billion. That's a fly on the wall to the amount of money that's in the hedge funds and the investment funds.
And I guess when I look at the fundamentals from the corn and the wheat, I can see that there's a lot of fundamental reasons now. The beans, it bothers me about the fundamental side of it, but I know if, you know, these guys throw money at it, that's an attractive place for them to come.
And the news follows the market in the long run. Remember back 6-8 months ago, I mean, we've come a long way in the corn fundamentals in 6 or 8 months to change them.
And really, the beans, you know, fundamentally shouldn't even be close to here. So you have to get, there's something underneath there that's doing something that, you know, we can't just pit our hands on.
And let's even put it on this other side of the coin in here. The one thing that might be fooling everybody is how much the value of the dollar might be falling. Because the dollar index is not falling outside of the range that we've established. We're still within the 12-month range, you know, highs and lows. We're still within that. But gold has more than doubled in price.
Yes.
If you value the dollar that way, the dollar has been cut in half in value. If that's the case, because I know there's people out there that, I mean, you talk about getting a resistance. I've been getting, you know, vehement resistance about even talking the friendly possibility in beans because that they're a buck or two overpriced. Well, I understand the fundamental side in terms of the ending stocks or the carryover projections. I understand that. But the other side of the coin is, if the dollar has truly fallen in value in half, then at $6 beans, we're already at $3 change.
Why the South American farmer is really struggling here. He's the guy that's paying the price for the dollar, and that just shows you where we are. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. You know, I mean, a few years ago, everybody said pack up and move to South America, American farmers buy land down there.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be in big trouble if you did that right now. So I wonder, too, what's your thoughts on next year? I mean, do you think those South American farmers, if this continues, will they cut back on beans and whatever else they can do, sugar cane, something else, corn? I mean,
let me say this. I don't think that we have any idea what next year is going to look like, because I think we've got too much to go through yet this year. I really do. I have long been worried, very long time been worried about the second quarter of 2006 having some kind of a major degree event in the marketplace. And I don't mean just... I mean something like, how do I say this without scaring too many people? You know, the Dow may have topped and go back to 7,400 here.
Oh.
Well, that's better than saying the Dow may have topped and is headed for 3,400.
Yeah, or 1,800, right?
Yeah. Well, let's go back. I've got the business cycle. I've tracked back to the 980 time frame, just coming out of the dark ages. And of course, I got gaps in there. I'm missing a couple of days around Labor Day and 1200 AD. But seriously, I've tracked the business cycle back, and what's really been interesting that really was brought to my attention in the last 24 months was the role that energy has played. Whatever the dominant energy source, you can go back to when firewood was it. When people started specializing, you had a silversmith or you had a harness maker or whatever back then, and you had the firewood salespeople, the collectors, and you have regularly had cyclical, not necessarily in terms of time, but in terms of behavior, energy crises. And whatever the dominant energy was, whether it was firewood, charcoal, coal, whatever, 100% correlation with a major economic downturn, normally 6 months to 2 years out, but the latest is 6 years out. When the crude oil went to a new high here recently, we just reset the clock that we got a 6 month, 2 year window to be looking for a major economic downturn, and I'm afraid now it's 6 weeks, not 6 months.
But part of this, too, you got to give the Chinese. I mean, they've come in and their energy consumption has gone way up. And you know, I think their currency, how they, you know, did some reevaluation here. I mean, they've been buying up a lot of our debt. So you got some economic currency factors that you got to work out that are maybe, you know, something different that we haven't had to deal with.
I understand that. But even other times when we started, when you go through the 1500s and 1600s, when you've got when we had another world market open up, then that's when you had a great increase in activity of sailing ships. The West Indies Trading Company, for example, became huge into the 1700s, things like that. So they had a world event the same way, and yet they still went through the same thing. So, and then we had the opening of this country, and we've seen the world go through the same thing. So I understand why we think it's different, and it does bother me. So it may change the magnitude, the time it takes, whatever. I highly doubt that it's going to change the pattern.
Is the bird flu, I mean, if that really ever jumps, I mean, we haven't seen any indication of that, but I mean, that could be a triggering mechanism that would just kind of stop trade if that really ever happens. I mean, so far we haven't seen any people really jump over, but I mean that's a negative out there that we worry about.
I think, and I'm not sure how it's going to impact. To be frank, I mean that seriously. I'm not doubting your statements at all. But what I'm saying is I've tried to ponder that one through, and I can come up with quite a few different scenarios. I could see it, for example, being quite bullish for beef and pork, theoretically. Meat counter here. When the bird flu stuff was going around overseas, I talk regularly to a retail meat manager managing a chain of stores here, and just to get a feel on things, and the anecdotal view, and basically when I came in to buy a roast, I complained that none of the beef was on sale, and he says, "Well, you know, buy a roast and I'll give you a chicken." I says, "I'll buy two if you'll keep them." But you know, he said people were literally coming up to the counter, housewives and stuff that were backing away from buying chicken just because of the talk of bird flu, and so. I don't know how that's going to play. I just don't.
What about a major event that would eliminate a number of people?
So that cycle's overdue.
And I guess I'm not talking about nuclear war.
No, I'm talking about
pandemic.
Like
HIV explodes in a way out of Africa that we have been fearful of.
Well, just take your time. It's going to happen anyway. There. The HIV thing is just—it's not a time bomb that goes off with a mushroom cloud.
I know.
It's one that's just like dominoes going over. I mean, how many more years, or a decade or two before you see we will see a tremendous change in the net population of the African continent. No, I agree with you. We're a 510-year cycle in human population is overdue, and we've lost a third to half—I should say a fourth to half—the world's. And what then was known, the known world's population on that cycle, we're due. And I don't know that we're going to lose that much this time because of modern technology, but I agree, we could lose a lot of demand in a hurry.
What about one thing we're looking at, Mike and I have been discussing too, is that, if let's say we pull back in these energies a little bit and grains or whatever, but then we got this hurricane season coming. And I think just the threat of a hurricane coming in there and disrupting our energy source again, I think that could kick back in everything in gear again, especially in the crude oil and the corn, and that may be a trigger factor for the beans again, too.
Well, one thing that I think that you're right there about, and this becomes a double-edged sword, do we prop the thing up on fears and then buy the rumor, sell the fact in those markets eventually, or do we get double whammies? I mean, you remember the bull market in the grains from 77 to 80. That was a three-legged rally, 3 years up, and each year had its own set of rallies. And we're not used to that in this day and age anymore to get, we've had, like the CRB, had a four-year almost continuous rally. But we have been a long time since we've had these legged rallies like that year after year. So you're right, we could get another one in the energies. But something out there that struck me the last couple of years, I've watched Elwin Taylor give his presentations, and how, last year was an extraordinarily active hurricane season. Well, it is based upon modern records, but his tree ring studies and his records that go back shows that we went through about 30, 40 years of abnormally low hurricane activity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one thing that intrigues me about the corn. Again, when you talk about lows, you haven't seen world carryovers at a low in 1975 and world ending stocks to use ratio since 1960. I mean,
Yeah.
We're living on the edge over there in the corn market with all this booming demand. That's.
And I think we come back to that one. Tell me how fast that fundamental picture changed. You know, 12 months ago, you know, 18 months ago. Where were
fast.
We?
Well, they said world stocks didn't matter, that you know, U.S. stocks were big, but you had two things change. You had all these ethanol plants jump out at you.
Sure.
And now, again, you know, it ought to be, you know, an issue that we're really going to run on the edge of world supplies and demand with the U.S. coming at you with ethanol.
I agree. But the one lesson we should remember is when the commodity world was in a bear mode going in through the 1990s, we had just extraordinarily tight numbers at times in wheat, and it didn't matter. But when we're on a bull phase, which we are still, I think, in the commodity world yet, we still are in a bull environment, I agree with you. These kind of numbers makes anything that goes wrong makes it all that more explosive.
And don't we always tend to overreact, whether it be too negatively
yes.
or too positively? And that's why I think there's still momentum there that can still be captured, because we're swinging a pendulum the other way.
That's what I'm scared of down the road on the energy side. I think economic value of crude oil is somewhere between $40 and $50. And if it is, eventually, with the ethanol stuff coming on, we're going to sometime in the next handful of years, we're going to bemoan surpluses for a time. Because like you just said, we overreact. We overmove in one direction. Time will come.
Can you go back very quickly? You mentioned during the program itself on the bean side that mm-hmm. It looked like a combination of 88, which of course was the drought year, and 83, which was the whole farm set-aside year.
Yeah.
But you didn't get a chance to finish that thought out.
83. I was close enough on that overall, but what I'm talking about is in 83 we rallied up into late winter, early spring, and then broke into and picked up a second half rally. And we were extra wet in Iowa in 83. Now the eastern part of the belt's extra wet, et cetera. And it looks like we've got the decennial drought pattern that affects the plains. Looks like it may be trying to kick back in. And, you know, I'm just worried about us being looking so good right now at the start of the year, on average in the Corn Belt, that we end up, like somebody said before the show talked, if we get the heat and, you know, warmth coming in, we start baking this stuff.
Well, then we had it. As I remember back there, we had, you know, the crop here got off to a slow start, too, and we had an early frost, and that zapped it at the end of the year. So it just wasn't a good year all around. So.
Yeah. And I know in 83, I was in South Dakota at the time, but I came down to Iowa on June 18th and drove down I-80 and saw corn standing in water. I came down again in late July, and that stuff was chest high and looked ripe. That's how fast it had changed.
And the other thing, too, it's intriguing. I mean, we really haven't had a problem for quite a while, and you know, it's kind of been pushed under the rug. I mean, we've said that in the last 4 or 5 years, but nothing ever really happened. So it's inevitable it's going to happen sometime.
Sure. But,
you know, you just don't like saying that anymore because that's not been what's happened.
Well, and based on weather cycles, too, on the Wheeler drought cycle and stuff like that, you know, we are in the high-risk window. We're in the five-year window right now. We're in the second, depending on how you count it, third year, I'd say the second full year of the high-risk window, where we're twice the normal risk to get a Corn Belt-type drought or heat and drought. And I was visiting with Alan Taylor here not long ago about the drought patterns and the fact that the droughts typically migrate out of the Carolinas into the Corn Belt. Of the last 17 droughts, I believe he said, one of them was one that started with a dry year in Illinois, appeared to fade, and then mushroomed the next summer into the Western Corn Belt. So, you know, we're drought cycle-wise and pattern-wise, there's a little bit of that wild card that we get hit by one that the average community doesn't see coming. And I think you're exactly right. When we're due one of these times, we're set up technically, we're set up cyclically, that this is the kind of year that I watch out for that surprising catalyst.
And even if it doesn't happen this year, again,
yes,
when you look at the carryover numbers, again, it just implies that next year and the year after, barring none of these bad things we talk about, you're going to have to get more acres and you're going to have good yields to meet this all these ethanol plants are not shutting down. They're going to build, Todd. They're going to have
absolutely
the corn.
Well, I wouldn't argue against that.
It's going to be when the ethanol plants start going broke that we start losing the demand again.
Very good.
Because we have a germination industry going on in the ethanol, and it's going to be off to bang like the internet boom was or the NASDAQ was, and then they're going to go through a contraction down the road. That's almost inevitable. But in the meantime, you know, that's a dynamic that we're going to have to live with on a multi-decade degree, at least on a short-term basis on that degree. We've got to live with that, whether it's a few years or a decade or more. We're going to have to live with that.
On that ethanol front, mm-hmm. how can you see the soybean-corn acreage mix balance out? I think we topped out at one point at about 100 million acres of corn. Can you see that change in... And does it work, or do those corn acres really have to be fairly close to the plants?
Well, that's one of the things I looked at last year. I mean, why I didn't think the corn acres would be down, because, again, rotation. I mean, if you're going to have more corn acres than they're talking, you're going to have corn on corn. Corn on corn is a tougher deal. I mean, there's a lot of guys in Indiana, and I see it in Illinois, even have gone to no-till corn because of the fuel and just the equipment savings.
Sure.
And conservation. Well, that's good, but no tilling into corn after corn, that's a tough game. So
yes,
I think there's just a natural barrier. Now, next year, if the bean acres are truly bigger this year, it's an easier switch to go back to that. But if we're really going to go for the ethanol plants and grow a lot more corn, we're going to have to grow corn on corn, and that's not the easiest thing to do, and generally maybe not, you don't get your best yields after that.
Maybe we do switchgrass.
Yeah.
What's the possibility that the energy policy actually shifts? Don't you think that the oil boys would prefer to have switchgrass next to them in Texas and Oklahoma, and not worry about an ethanol plant fed by corn?
I think the oil boys would rather have switchgrass next to them in Iowa. I think because from what I've heard from them, now I'm not an expert on it, but from what I've heard from them, they'd rather deal with that product in the long run.
And see, I think there's another issue that's yet to come is we've always kind of had a cheap food policy in this country. If we're using all this corn, and I've seen people talk about it in the non-farming community, well, if corn's way up there and we burn it all up, for the human side of the equation?
Well, don't you think is the writing not on the wall? The Bush administration talked about switchgrass in the State of the Union address. He didn't say ethanol. He said biofuels and switchgrass at that point. It seems to me that somebody in Washington, the think tank people, really have thought about, well, cheap food supply, cheap energy, cheaper energy cost, and somebody's thought about this longer term, and I don't think they're thinking corn.
But I think the practicality of that, Todd, I have a problem with.
Yeah.
Corn's an easy switchover, and the energy is so compacted in that bushel of corn. When you start talking about hauling switchgrass and however you're going to get it in there,
that's big, isn't it?
The switchgrass is going to lend itself to the southern Iowa, northern Missouri,
conservation
Dakota,
areas,
the rolling hills, the areas that corn is a more iffy crop. So that's really my answer on the ethanol thing. What's going to happen with the markets, et cetera? It's going to depend upon your region and what percentage of the demand in your region. You take the Dakotas, where right now they think they're great putting up these numerous ethanol plants, and because they've been getting Corn Belt yields in recent years. If they, in fact, go back to Dakota yields, because the weather patterns in South Dakota, eastern Dakotas, have not been historically normal. They've been producing beyond their abilities on a long-term basis. Those guys are going to be crushed because of how fast they're going to drain the cash corn out of their markets. You take another area where your average yields are a lot higher and the ethanol plants are a smaller percentage of the demand, they'll be able to tolerate it.
Iowa, for instance.
Iowa, into Illinois, et cetera, I think they'll tolerate it for quite a while. I also think, though, I kind of think if I try to get in the head of a politician, I think they love the ethanol plants.
Oh yeah,
because they start to solve the farm spending problem. because as you start cleaning up the bases with ethanol, what does that happen to do to your postal county prices over time?
Yeah, but about the time we write a new farm bill, and this whole thing, you're always behind the envelope, and then the ethanol plants get into trouble or corn goes up. I mean, then they're always behind in those programs and how they figure it's going to work. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting. On that subject, while we're there, I mean, what do you perceive in the farm bill? I mean, I think they're going to look at high prices when they're writing it, or generally higher prices next winter.
I think that I don't think that the market environment and the political environment. Let's put it to you this way: the farmer has seen his top in influence. I don't think things will get better for the farmer. That's what I see in the farm bill.
We always want farm prices to be really low in the midst of the farm bill.
Yes.
Discussion.
That is historically just so accurate and funny.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's very true, because then you get sympathetic politicians. But when you're looking at it in this form, with good prices, with the WTO still there, and even without the WTO at this point, if they simply go back and say, let's work it out on what's already in place, it still doesn't bode well for farm programs, unless you liked Freedom to Farm, which was the first WTO reaction when it was GATT. And in 91, they sat down and in 91, Europe and the United States sat down and they hammered out the agricultural agreement on the GATT. And that's exactly, somebody was on talking, saying Pat Robertson wrote the last farm bill. Well, Pat Robertson copied the last farm bill out of the WTO, if you really want to talk about it, I think. But that's exactly what that farm bill, I think, may end up. It's not exactly what it will end up looking like, but it's the way it might pay out.
I think
The
one thing that might save the farm bill for the farmers is the growth and cost of the farm bill, with prices being up, should be manageable. In light of, if we continue to see the trend we are on the government receipts, the government's starting to take, you know, from this war effort to spending all the money that we've had flood into the economy, we're seeing their receipts grow. And thus, as a percentage of the budget, the farmers will probably be able to sneak in and might be able to stay okay because of the hard numbers of dollars that they'll be able to maintain. That's the one saving grace that I see in this environment for them right now.
I want to ask kind of a different question of the two of you. I was looking at some of the maps that USDA develops, and I was looking at the corn yield map, actually, and I did not realize that Illinois, in terms of corn yield, lagged Iowa quite so much on a county-by-county basis, that Iowa just has very productive soils.
Yeah.
So the question I have for you is this. If you're doing a 1031 exchange and you're in a collar county of Chicago, or you're out of Indianapolis or somewhere in Ohio, where, and you had your choice, where would you put a farm down?
Depends upon what your purpose of it is.
Well, your purpose is to farm. But forget the family ties. Where would you put a farm?
I was an investor, or if I was a farmer?
You're the farmer.
The only other caveat that I need on that question I'd want answered on that is if I want to be in livestock or not. If I do want to be...
You don't want to be in livestock.
I don't want to... You're talking about cash grain farmer.
You're just a cash grain farmer.
Yeah. It wouldn't matter that much to me between the two. Because I'd tell you, at that point, I'd probably say the best deal I could get made... But from a production, if I just wanted to farm and felt that the most important thing was production security, you buy the best.
And I guess my answer would be that the thing about, I mean, Iowa soils always amazed me because of the rolling soil around in our part of the world of Indiana that would be less productive. But I guess I would prefer the wide open, flat, big fields of Illinois over some of the rolling fields of parts of Iowa.
Yeah, that's I agree with you on that, but that's I go back to that statement. I'd throw that into buying the best. I wouldn't buy the little patches in Iowa. I'd buy them, because there's plenty of areas here where you can get some large fields and stuff, but if you just blindly buy, you're right. You're going to run into that, but that's the only
one thing I'll say about Iowa that we have trouble in Indiana. I mean, your roads are nice and wide out there in the country roads, and there's plenty of room for big equipment. That's one of the problems in the eastern Corn Belt. Sure. As populations have grown, it's difficult to get equipment around.
And they're showing up here, and we're really having a lot of trouble with the investor money now driving farmers away, or not, you know, competitive-wise. You're harder and harder to buy, especially the northeast part of this, northern two tiers of counties and on over to the Mississippi River area. In fact, the poorer farm ground, the rolling hills, is harder to buy because of the investor types. We're getting spilled out of the Twin Cities.
They're wanting to buy it as a homestead because they want to live in the in pretty countryside.
Come down for the weekend. They go hunting. They go, you name it. They're buying it for a getaway. Yep. And they're buying it for investment purposes, too. But, you know, kind of half investment, half just to own. And they can't, I mean, you go up to Rochester, Minnesota. I did a meeting up there a couple of years ago. And in the entire farm audience, only one of the farmers owned his farm.
Well, that's bad news.
Yeah, because they said they couldn't buy any. And the investors were already saying they can't even buy them from each other.
I'd heard that Minnesota, that those places up there were really getting too expensive for the production that they can get out of the soils.
The fortunate ones are getting to farm them back, and the owners are not owning them for the, you know, they're so well off they don't need them. They don't need to make a profit on them. They're just long term ownership.
I guess my part of my question was, I was hopeful that the soils in Iowa and the rougher ground is what I was thinking, the rolling ground, that where you'd have to have smaller plots, that you'd have 40s and 60s and 80s and not 220s or 400 or whatever it might be, that would be a bit of a salvation for small farmers, relatively small acreage. But if it's all getting bought up, I see a division where you end up with 3, 5, 10,000 acre farms.
Yeah.
On the big wide open lands, and then I was kind of hopeful that you because of the small track size that it would be smaller farms in those
but I,
areas.
I think you made a good point earlier, Todd. You're asking about how, you know, if you're a younger guy, get into it, and
where are you going to go?
My son just got out of Purdue. I mean, I think that's a problem coming down the road as far as where are we going to get the next generation of farmers to come in, because it's difficult to get in right now, as you say.
Yeah.
But there's
going to
be a big void out there when people retire.
Well, I think there will be.
My farm audience, too, that I meet with on a monthly basis, just an extraordinary number of them, the kids are not staying home.
Yeah, you know? When we do meetings, we do go out and do well radio meetings, look around the audience, Todd, how many young guys are in there? Proportionally, there's hardly enough to take over what we have, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but it's changed over the last decade. When we first started doing those meetings back in early 90, mm-hmm. man, the heads were bald and gray, and most of those people are probably not with us anymore.
They've been planted.
There were a lot. Yeah, they've been planted. There were a lot of really old, and it's a lot younger. There's a lot of gray hair, but there's a lot of black still in it. I think the audience that we see in our
is coming, but again, is there enough to replace that? And that's
well,
what
if they're
I
twice as big,
about.
There probably is.
Yeah, the flip side of that is just that, is how many do we require to mm-hmm. replace it? That's the tough question. I think to re-answer your question about where to buy, yeah, there are going to be opportunities in Iowa for the guy that's willing to farm 20, 40, and have his big field be 80 acres. Yeah, there's going to be opportunities for that over here. There's no question about it. But Iowa is not so universally that way that it's limiting to the guy with that can buy 1,000 or 2,000 acres to be able to put some big tracks together either.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you, if you really want that issue on that side of the coin, I'll go back to where I came from, and I can offer you up a couple of counties if you want them. South Dakota.
Yeah. Well,
of course, it might take a couple of counties to produce what we can on 80 acres here in Iowa.
Well, you said the weather was going to get bad out there, so we may want to skip that.
Can we wait until the weather's really bad when we come in and buy it really cheap, and then we'll just put switchgrass on it?
Well, I tell you what, when I left South Dakota, western South Dakota, I might have paid you to take it. It was bad enough. So, I mean, I had farmed, my dad died in 74, and I farmed till 83, and I had rain in 2 years. Of course, I had enough rain in those 2 years to make the average, but for all those years.
Wow.
But, I mean, I literally went through 1 year with zero rainfall. And so, I mean, that's country is something else. That's survival. One market we didn't touch on in the meeting, in the show, that I thought there's something very significant happened this week. and that is in December Chicago wheat. In fact, I should check and see the number, but I think we closed up around 446.7, something like that. 440 since 1981 has stopped us five times, three times 440 exactly yearly highs. Twice we've gone through it. Once was on a bear market bounce. Only one time since the since 1981 have we gone through 440 on an uptrend, a true uptrend. And then we proceeded, the December contract went to 535 before it expired, and the next year, 1996, we were over $6.
Why though, with the Chicago soft red being, we're not running out, and again, we felt guys are going to plant more acres next year. It's interesting that it can gain that much strength. I mean, is it the spec money coming after it, or what's going on?
Well, path of least resistance now, to me, to be very honest with you, why doesn't matter, except for this. I don't think that the marketplace yet has adjusted for the loss of the hard red production. I really don't.
But you can't substitute.
How about cool, wet weather, and we get big disease problems?
Well, that, yep.
That can come.
And we've got that in the east here, and
yeah.
it is.
I think that, you know, we're sitting here right now. I need to look and see what December Kansas City wheat is priced at to see how much over Chicago was. Because in the last 12 months, memory serves me, we had we spent a time where Kansas City and Chicago wheat were almost evenly priced for a time. And these Kansas City wheat now is at 513 on this week's close. So now we're... You know, we're talking about being almost 65 cents over the Chicago. How much is enough? Can you substitute it? Not very well, not totally by any means, but you certainly take away any of the hard wheat that would have competed with the soft at any time, because you can substitute the other way more easily.
Well, and that's another positive for the corn market, because the wheat is not going to be a feed competitor out there either.
Not at all. The only question is what are they going to do with those acres if they get rain? That are dead, because I mean, people were challenging me earlier this year when I saw wheat start up, saying, "Well, how can it go to da 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 da? What if it rains in Kansas and Oklahoma?" And I said, "You know, having raised wheat, been a winter wheat producer myself for even with my dad when I was young, I knew one thing already for the style of winter we had down there: dead wheat. Doesn't matter how much it rains, it ain't going to grow." And so I was not at all surprised when the crop tour numbers came back. The question I have is how much grain sorghum is going to go in, or what's going to go in place of it, and if they get rain, now we get some feedback. You know, but without it, the wheat situation is tight out there. And like I say, you know, Chicago's always been the universal recipient. It could take spring wheat, winter wheat, whatever would actually be deliverable against Chicago contract, and actually somewhat substitutable. You can blend it with the soft wheat at times. But you don't go the other way.
Well, where they're getting us on the basis on the soft red is horrendous.
I mean,
they are just ripping the basis apart. And the other thing I was going to bring up, too, is that there was a lot of spreading going on, you know, the Kansas City being bought and Chicago being sold. Maybe those folks there have decided, you know, with the spec money or enough's enough, and that's part of the reason the Chicago's come back is those guys liquidating their short side.
Except that the Kansas City remained quite resilient, too. But you're right. It may be that the Kansas City may just hold on its own. They may just start lifting the short legs,
right,
too. The Kansas City, though, July Kansas City is up against some resistance around 510. And that's interesting, too, to me, is that December Chicago went through. July did not. 430 has got multi-year highs, different years that we've had highs in this area. So we're going to have to get through this week's highs. But history says that you don't top wheat in May. You top it in April or you top it in June, July. So I think we probably have more to go, and it looks like an updraft going here to me on wheat. One other thing, I got to before I forget that, I'm ADHD, guys, so I bounce around in my thoughts. The statement that somebody made that everybody's bullish. I hear that, but by their actions, by the anecdotal evidence that I watch, the actions I hear people looking for places to sell, talking about selling, not talking about buying, talking about selling, and watching the farmers having my grain buyers tell me they bought four to five times as much new crop grain for this year, and they're so far ahead on 2007 than they've ever bought. That is just incredible. All those actions tell me that really the behavior is not bullish.
Well, when the grain is bought out of the farmer's hands, that's when the market can really get going. That's an old saying. And the Chicago traders we work with, and some have been guests on this show, I mean, there's still a fair amount of pessimism amongst those folks in Chicago that, you know, this makes little sense to them. So I don't know. I mean,
I think across the board, it started in the beans, that, well, why are we here? We don't know, but we ought to be lower. And I think in the corn pit that there's not nearly as much of that, but there's an awful lot of caution and that they're willing to make sales.
A lot of producers say it's too good to be true. You know, not thinking it's going to stay. You're right. I agree. And wheat, you know, maybe a legitimate reason to be running on the hard.
But that's what, you know, we're talking
that's
about.
That's impressive on the charts when you look at the numbers there. When you're just technically looking at this week, that's an impressive run.
Well, wheat has gone almost a buck in the last month.
Yeah.
The one thing we didn't spend much time on, I mean, we got a little bit. I mean, but what do you do about it as a producer? I mean, that's all this is great, but, I mean, it is a tough job for a farmer to deal with this. And, I mean, we've got guys that, you know, I mean, I know where you're coming from in the futures. I mean, it takes guys with some deep pockets and some money to do that. It's a right thing to do. We got some guys doing it, but
you mean buying it?
Well, or you're going to short sell it as a hedge or whatever. That's where, you know, the only way we've been able to find with most guys is a put option as a tool. It gets something done, allows you to hang in there. You got to be careful how many times you roll up. I mean, that's part of our strategy. I mean, you want to move up and capture it, but you can't do that 10 times either. You know, you're going to put a lot of money.
I've been looking for spreading opportunities on the rolls. A couple of years ago, in 2004, I made a bundle by, you know, backspreading where I would sell one put option and buy two lower put options.
Right.
And then as it went up, I rolled it. I kept rolling it and never selling more than I originally sold. And yet I kept ending up by lifting the short ones and rolling it up each time, doing the same event over again. I kept ending up with more and more put options underneath me for the same exposure. We haven't had the premiums work that way this year to allow me to do that, but I'm watching for that opportunity to type doing. So that's one way to cheapen up. The other thing I will look for in here at some point, and this would be for the more sophisticated producers, is, and I haven't spent any time on it yet, so I'm just saying in terms of hypothetical, I would be here setting and debating about maybe I can pick up some option premium someplace. For the more sophisticated guys, so selling some option premium rather than buying it.
I saw some strategies proposed in the July wheat Chicago of selling both puts and calls and saying that we're, you know, we might take a break for a little while here before those expire in July and then kind of play that spread. But it's awful volatile.
I want to make sure a guy is, you know, you're going to sell them against, it's like selling covered calls. You're going to be selling them against your crop. You're not going to be, I certainly don't want them speculating, you know, straight out. I want to be part of a hedging-type strategy, something to consider. So be very, very careful about just, you know, naked selling without matching it to their production somehow.
And that's where the guys that are moving out there and selling 07 and 08 crop, we've been trying to tell them. I mean, it's a good level compared to where we've been, but it might be worthwhile spending 8 or 10 cents on that call just in case.
Sure.
Yeah.
The hurricane, the whatever we've been talking about comes in there, you got enough money there to you better use a little bit of that to cover what you're doing.
I have one producer in particular that's been doing some selling at times and using just short time frame calls to protect himself against things getting away from him. And then he'll make his move. He's talking about, you know, he's either selling some cash grain or did some hedging. He's done this for the last couple of years, and he's had very good luck there keeping himself from getting wrapped up in anything, getting in any serious trouble. And it's been able to protect him against a couple of the bursts that we've had in the marketplace. Now, again, that's for a more sophisticated guy doing his homework. So as a blanket strategy, this is a tough, tough one to make to take advantage of.
What do you think about 08? I mean, I have some people that are 50% sold out there.
I have no idea what the value of anything is that far out because of the unknowns in the dollar and stuff like that. What happens if the dollar index breaks 80? You know, that's record lows. So if we take that out, do we have, because then all of a sudden, you know, you go to McDonald's and you get change back from your 100 if you're there alone and it's a Happy Meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we don't. I don't know what value is out there. So any selling out there, I tell people, you're welcome to sell those numbers, and I don't discourage them from merchandising, but I says make darn certain you got a trap door on the top side.
And that's where the currencies and the value of the dollar are really show up, because again, the Brazilian farmer is being penalized now, and as an American producer, you look out there and go, yeah, that's a good number compared to where we are. But again, I think you brought up a great point. Is that a number that we just like the three, or is it a number that means we're going to make money out there?
It's the number we like the three. You know the answer to the question.
Well, you remember it was 10 years ago, people would have given their left leg and a few other parts of their body to sell cattle in the upper 70s.
Right.
And now they're sick of their grand the gills that they have to sell cattle in the upper 70s.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be very, very careful the marketplace doesn't revalue itself. History going back, taking these studies I've done back in over 1,000 years of markets, we typically turn commodities sideways for 20 to 30 years and then take another leg up. That's just a generalization. The problem that we have in the modern era is we have no time that we have gone this long with a fiat currency. Every time before this, we've been measuring against gold. So I don't... the dollar becomes such a wild card as to what it could do to us.
Now, the other thing that is concerning, a lot of that's going on, we talked about earlier, is that this is in hedge to arrives.
Mm-hmm.
I have to question that if we see this market happens to get excited, we saw what happened before with hedge to arrives. Are the farmers that are doing that going to be receiving some pretty big requests for margin money?
Sure.
I think that's a legitimate thing that those guys that are doing that, I mean, it's a risk they need to consider or understand that it's an environment when the market could be explosive, and that could be a dangerous thing to do if you're not covered.
They're on the same. They're looking at a similar thing when they invest in an ethanol plant.
Amen.
Right?
Amen.
I mean, sure. I was looking at one of the plants here as a possibility. I don't own farmland, don't have the corn, but I was looking to invest in it. And, mm-hmm. of course, you have to come up with corn. They'd be willing and more than happy to buy it for you. But if corn gets too expensive, I was in this particular plant, and I think this is the way most of those corn contracts are written. I was responsible for as much money as I had invested to begin with.
Many of these guys think they're getting into a limited liability situation, and it may be limited, but it isn't limited to what they think it is. So I think my understanding is you're correct.
Well, I know I was correct on that one.
Yeah, and I think that's more common than people realize.
I think they need to read those corn contracts and those things.
They've got to be very, very careful on that.
The environment we're in, I guess it just goes back to, again, the swings can be in the next few years and certainly in the coming months extreme. And that's always an uncomfortable place to be, no matter whether you're a producer, you're a buyer, whatever. And that's tough to deal with, and that's what... You know, and Commodity Week is, you know, dealing with this spring and summer is going to be valuable to the producer out there.
The one thing, too, that the one thing I do know about historical behavior patterns is that if we get explosive in the grains, basis widens even more, which it often doesn't on a drought-driven bull market. You'll actually get, you know, you start tightening up the cash eventually anyway. But if it widens even more this year, what will probably happen is whenever we finally top those markets, you get that initial downdraft in the futures, you typically shut off the cash selling. And it may be a few days or maybe just a few weeks, but you might get a real sudden tightening of basis. And I've told my producers to be alert for that situation this year, that you may get just a really brief window that they might think is just an aberration, that they may get a chance to lock in some of these hedge to arrives to the basis part.
Yeah, we've been telling guys, again, to wait or get as far out there and just hang out and wait till we get past this surplus of 05 corn. And that's a huge, I think, a pivot point out there. When we get over that hump, things are going to change dramatically. We're just not there, and it's going to take till fall to get over the hump.
I had some guys early on this year, that a couple of brothers that were putting some hedge to arrives out, and the basis at that time was only 39. And I said, do you think we should take it? And I said, well, what are you after? And they said, well, 35. I said, you're worrying about 4 cents. And I've already, you know, we had already gone through the discussion how basis likely to widen.
Yeah, I did that in wheat. I did some hedge to rise, and then what I thought was a good basis, I was waiting for, and it's just, I finally said it, but it was really not a thing to do to wait. It hurt me a lot.
The other thing that might start happening here is, that we might start seeing have to happen or to put some pressure onto these markets. I don't mean price pressure, but I'm talking about in terms of getting the bases back. We may actually have to have somebody start making a concerted effort to actually start delivering again.
Mm-hmm.
But that means selling it, you know, selling it now before the market pulls down to the cash.
You mean in Chicago?
Yes. Selling the July corn, for example, if you say this number is good enough to me, and delivering that sucker. Now, granted, you got to be in a reasonable point or go to work on it. But I just think, you know, at some point, that's why, you know, I don't believe in the efficient market theory because it doesn't hold up under various tests. But there's parts of it that's true. And any time, if we keep running this wide basis, somebody's going to finally decide there's enough opportunity there to start creaming that out on delivering against those contracts.
But some of these funds, I remember that German index fund a few months ago, 600 contracts. I didn't even understand the process, or I presume that's what happened to them. But, I mean, there's money out there that doesn't know how it works.
No, and it's going to get ugly before it's done. I'm talking about, you know, some
they
days
never called back.
This thing's going to be ugly.
Well, and that's why, you can see that one-week contract, the last time it went to 750 or whatever in the last 15 minutes watching that thing. That's what happened right there. You get me the wheat, and they didn't have it, and that caused that extreme high.
Yeah, and I think that's we're going to have horror stories, whether there are a lot of individual incidental horror stories like that or some big ones, we're going to increasingly have horror stories come out of this thing in the next few years. There's no question in my mind. So,
hard assets and land are still the place to be, no matter what happens in the coming year or two?
Throughout the history of man.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
On that note.
Yep, I got to run. I got a wife looking for me to take her out.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thanks,
good
Glenn.
To talk with you.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
Glenn Ring, of course, with Glenn Ring Enterprises. He's out of Cedar Falls, Iowa. Chuck Shelby's been with us on what's our extra edition of Commodity Week. We call it After the Bell. I will make one more bid here that if you've been listening to this program, it's just an extra thing that we do for WILL. The only place this actually shows up is in the newsletter. And if you've gotten the newsletter and you've listened all the way through this, I hope that it was worth your while. If it is, take a look, hit the website, dial this number, pledge your financial support to us if you can. The number there is 217-244-9455. I'll repeat it slowly and then I won't do it again. It's 217-244-9455, 244-WILL. Thanks much and have a safe week. Remember, when you're out there planting those beans yet this week, be careful. I know it's late. Take a nap in the afternoon. Try to listen to me and you can fall asleep in the middle of that for 15 minutes and then you can go to 10 o'clock at night if you need to. All right. Bye-bye.